Hello, my name is Dr. Vivian Low. This is VLMD Rounds. Welcome back. My voice might be a little gruff today. I'm not sure. I just got over being sick, so I hope it's not too bad, but I am way behind schedule, so we're going to make this episode happen. Before I get started, though, there are a few people I'd like to acknowledge. First of all, Drew Gong from Australia. I hope you're listening in. I did see your comments. Thank you very much for leaving them. And you requested topics on nutrition and also resistance training. I'll definitely make sure to cover those. All right. There's also Vivek Down Under. I think you're also from Australia. So yay, I got friends in Australia. Again, thank you for listening in. Thank you for taking the time to leave comments. And if there's anything you'd like me to cover that you might find helpful, then please let me know. And then here in the US, as usual, I'd like to thank Brown Coat Blue and also Thomas. Thank you so much for listening and leaving me comments and giving me feedback. In addition, if you're watching on YouTube, you'll see these beautiful flowers, and these are from Anne. Anne sent me these flowers and cooked me a really nice meal when I was sick. I am very grateful. I have a warm, full tummy because of you, Anne, and I thought these flowers were too pretty to sort of leave in a corner, so I'm showing them off here. Thank you. All right, so many wonderful people who have been very supportive, and I certainly hope that you're getting a lot out of this podcast. Again, if there's anything you'd like me to cover, please let me know in the comments, write to me. You can also go to my website, vivianlowmd.com. And in addition, please don't forget to like and subscribe to my channel. Okay, I think I covered all of that. So in the previous episode, we talked about low blood sugar and how that's regulated in your body. In this episode, we're going to cover the opposite, all right? When you have hyperglycemia or high blood sugar and how that's regulated in your body and why we even care about high blood sugar anyway. Let's go. Okay, so in the fasting context, and again, we always have to look at the context when we're defining something. In the fasting context, I said that your blood sugar levels really should be between 75 and 100 milligrams per deciliter, right? After you've had an overnight fast of maybe 10 to 12 hours. Now, after all that time, if we check your blood sugar, and it's above 100, then you would be hyperglycemic in that context. You're not supposed to have a blood sugar higher than 100 milligrams per deciliter when you've not eaten anything for 12 hours. So that would be considered high blood sugar. Also, if you have had a meal and 2 hours after that meal, or what we say 2 hours postprandially, right, you have a blood sugar level of 140 milligrams per deciliter, that would be considered high blood sugar. You really should be below that, okay, a good way below that. So if you're 140 and above 2 hours after a meal, then yeah, that's high blood sugar, okay. Now, we have a total blood volume of about 5 liters or so in your body, right? And sometimes I ask patients to guess how much sugar is in those 5 liters. So like how many teaspoons of sugar would be in the 5 liters of blood that's circulating in your body at any point in time? And I had one patient guess 2,000 teaspoons. Okay, it's not 2,000 teaspoons, but a second person then guessed 200 teaspoons, Okay. And other people, it was a class that I was teaching, started throwing out numbers. Mostly they were saying something in the range of 100 plus teaspoons of sugar. Okay. And I think it's because they think, well, you know, it's 5 liters of blood. They, you know, that's probably need a few hundred teaspoons of sugar. The truth is 1 teaspoon. Yeah. 1 teeny little teaspoon in the 5 liters of blood in your body. Okay. Yeah. Sometimes people don't expect that. All right. Now, I have patients who go, well, you know, I don't eat a lot of sugar, Dr. Lo. Not much at all. Just once in a while, I may just have a little bite of something. So let's just consider this. If you were to have a slice of bread, depending on the brand and, you know, the actual size, that would be about 4 to 5 teaspoons of sugar in that one slice of bread. Okay. And, you know, if you're having a sandwich, right, normally a sandwich, you have a slice in the bottom, a slice at the top. So that's 2 slices of bread. And that would be 8 to 10 teaspoons of sugar. Okay. And you're only supposed to have 1 teaspoon in those 5 liters. And you just had 8 to 10 teaspoons. Yeah. Okay. I'll let that sink in a little bit. So clearly, you know, when we think that we're having just a little bit, it could be way more than your body normally handles at a time. So what's the big deal though, right? Who the heck cares? It's just a few teaspoons more here or there. What's the big deal? Well, you hear people talk about how sugar is bad for you, how sugar is damaging, and how sugar can hurt your body, right? And when I ask patients to be a little bit more specific, generally they draw a blank. They go, well, you know, it's just not good for you. It's not healthy, right? And, you know, I think it would be a good idea to kind of go into some of the mechanisms by which sugar can affect your body. All right, so the first thing we're going to talk about right now is a subject that I don't really like very much, but it's about cooking. I don't cook, okay? So don't listen to any advice from me on cooking. However, I will be talking about chemistry in cooking right now, so you can listen to me about that, all right? And this is something called the Maillard reaction. This is a fancy French name that a lot of times people don't know how to pronounce, but I've been told that it's the Maillard reaction. So there we go. Hope I said that right. And it's essentially the reason that your meats, for example, when you cook them, get nice and brown and smell so good. Okay, if you will remember in the episode on carbohydrates, I made it a point to mention that the monosaccharides, the simple sugars, are all reducing sugars. And by that, I mean that they have chemical groups that allow them to donate the hydrogens, okay, in chemical reactions. This is important because it allows them to react, in this case, specifically with proteins, okay? So we have, if you're cooking meat, then it's mostly proteins. And we have these amino groups. These are nitrogen bonded to hydrogen, so it's NH3 groups in amino acids, right? And they can react with these simple sugars, okay? Now, the reactions can be very complicated. It starts off fairly simple, but then, you know, quickly becomes quite complicated because you have different double bonds forming and shifting and structures changing, right? And eventually you start to form these very complex structures, which are actually between these proteins and the sugars. Now, these reactions occur without the need of any enzymes, so they can spontaneously occur. And they tend to, when you're cooking, occur between temperatures of, I think it's 140 to 165 Celsius, and that's like, what is it, 280 to 330 Fahrenheit, okay? So when you're cooking at those temperatures, you tend to see these reactions. Now, these reactions actually occur in nature, in your body, right? But in small amounts over time, okay? And we have these proteins that then react with the sugars to form these strong covalent bonds. Now, these bonds are very stable, and once they form, they are irreversible. Okay, so it's kind of a permanent thing once you form these bonds, right? When you cook, you have really a lot of these reactions going on, and you have these complex structures that are formed that give your food the amazing smells and the rich sort of brown color that you see once you've cooked it. So I've been told I don't cook. But yeah, apparently you have these wonderful aromatic flavors that come about from this reaction. Okay, and like I said, you don't need any enzymes for it to form. It just kind of happens with that, with the temperature and over time. These products are called advanced glycation end products. Advanced, A, glycation, G, end products, E. Okay, so sometimes people refer to them as AGES, A-G-E-S, okay, or AGES. So these glycation products, as I said, you can't actually remove them once they've been formed. You can't get rid of the combination of the protein to the sugars. Now, under normal circumstances, your body can process a few of these products, and your kidneys will get rid of them over time. But if you overwhelm your system, if you overwhelm the body with the formation of these AGES, then that would be too much for the kidneys to handle, and they start to accumulate in the body. Also, if you actually go to a slightly higher temperature than the ones I just mentioned, especially in plant-based foods like cereal grains and potato, you will form acrylamide, okay? Acrylamide, which, yeah, it doesn't sound good, but you get this especially like in potatoes. So if you've heard of French fries, when they deep fry the potatoes, you actually start to form the acrylamide, which in animal studies, that's been shown to be carcinogenic, right? So, not very good. But back to the normal advanced glycation end products, or the AGES. These things, once they're formed, they tend to gunk things up. So the sugars now have attached to the proteins permanently, right? And they impact the functioning of those proteins. Okay, the other thing that they do is that they start to basically cause an inflammatory reaction in cells. Now, we have cells like immune cells, neutrophils, macrophages, my favorite, right? But also endothelial cells. These are the cells lining your blood vessels and you have also vascular smooth muscle cells. These are cells in the walls of the blood vessels. Now, when they contract, those smooth muscle cells, then your blood vessels will constrict and narrow. And when they relax, your blood vessels dilate. So they kind of control your blood pressure as well. Well, all those cells, the immune cells, the endothelial cells lining the blood vessels, these vascular smooth muscle cells, they contain a receptor for the advanced glycation end products. So receptor R for the advanced glycation end products, the AGEs, right? So they're called the RAGE receptor. I know, receptor again would be redundant, but yeah, we'll just say RAGE receptor, right? So these cells contain a receptor for these AGEs. And when the AGEs bind to these receptors, it causes the cell to send out inflammatory signals because these are damaging substances. And so the cell goes, I don't think this is good. And it signals other cells around it that something is wrong. In addition, these RAGEs, the receptors, when they are bound to the advanced glycation end products, right, they can also stimulate another enzyme in the cell membrane called NADPH oxidase. We just call that enzyme NOX. Okay, it's shortened to NOX, N-O-X, okay? And it really is the NADPH oxidase, but it's easier to call it NOX. Now, NOX is actually very, very inflammatory, okay? There are many things that can set off NOX, that enzyme. For example, your renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system. I'll probably maybe do an episode on that in the future. But once NOX is stimulated, it is responsible for the formation of reactive oxygen species. Reactive R, oxygen O, species S. So we refer to those as ROS. Okay. And when we talk about these reactive species, we're talking about molecules that have unpaired or unevenly paired electrons in their orbits. And as a result of that, they become volatile and reactive. They're not stable, and they tend to have reactions with other molecules around them and can cause a lot of damage. So if we form a lot of the ROS because the NOX is stimulated, then we're going to have a lot of these damaging reactive oxygen species around in the cell. So the ROS can damage the cell, it can damage the organelles in the cell, in particular the mitochondria as well, and that can cause, you know, cell death eventually, okay? So when you have these AGEs binding to the RAGE receptor, then we can stimulate a lot of formation of this reactive oxygen species, which in itself is very inflammatory and will set the cell off in a path that can cause damage. All right. One other thing I want to mention here is that an age that we often talk about without thinking of it as an age is the hemoglobin A1C. So heme is a protein, it's a porphyrin protein, pretty big protein, right? And it can have this reaction with the reducing sugars, right? All those monosaccharides. And as a result, we form advanced glycation end product. So we call that a glycated heme protein or glycated hemoglobin because, you know, the heme is part of the hemoglobin in your red blood cells. So when we talk about hemoglobin A1C, we're essentially talking about this reaction where the sugar has bound irreversibly to the protein that is in the red blood cell. Okay, and once that reaction happens, I told you, anytime you have glycation happening, it can gunk up the structure of the protein and interfere with how that protein normally functions, so that those red blood cells that have glycated hemoglobin, they don't function as well. They tend to clump up and aggregate, right? And they are deformed and they don't do their normal function very well. When you're looking at the hemoglobin A1C, when you're measuring that in a patient, essentially what you're looking at is the percent of the red blood cells that have their hemoglobins glycated by sugar in your blood sample. All right, so if you have a hemoglobin A1C of 6%, then 6% of that sample has been glycated. And this gives you a general sense of what your blood sugar levels have been over the last, let's say, 3 months or so. 3 months because a red blood cell lives for about 120 days, right? At any point in time in your blood, you have a mixed sample, some old red blood cells, some young ones, some newly born ones, right? So when we look at the A1C, it's just an estimate of what levels of blood sugar you've had over the last 3 months. Okay, the higher the blood sugar levels, the more glycation happens, and then you have a higher percentage that would be glycated. Okay, so anytime you have higher levels of sugar in your blood, then more of these advanced glycation end products are formed. And then there's more inflammation and more damage. In addition, these sugars can also activate protein kinase C. And this is a signaling pathway. What it does is very dependent on the cell type. It's involved in transcription regulation, proliferation and growth, and regulation of the immune system. In general, though, when you have a lot of the sugars activating protein kinase C, then you have, again, augmentation of inflammatory pathways in your body. Sugars can also cause a biochemical reaction where you accumulate the sugar alcohols in your body, and these sugar alcohols can be very osmotically active, and so they draw a lot of fluids to them. And when that happens, depending on where in the body it is, that extra fluid can damage cells. So for example, if it happens in the eye, if it happens in the kidneys, you can damage those cells in those organs, okay? And then you also have a pathway called the hexosamine pathway. And this is where we actually normally modify proteins in the cell, right? And we add little carbohydrate groups to them. That's a normal process. But if you overwhelm the cell with a lot of these sugars, then you can also impact that normal process in a negative way. Okay, so when we actually modify proteins in the cell, we call that process glycosylation. I just want to make that distinction. Glycosylation is when you actually attach some of these carbohydrate groups to proteins as you process them in the endoplasmic reticulum, in the Golgi, right? And this is a normal process. You have enzymes in your body and the cells that do that. Okay, so glycosylation is a normal process. But again, if that process is overwhelmed and there's a lot of endoplasmic reticulum stress, then you can cause damage as well. Glycation, no enzymes involved, remember? And also, this happens normally in your body in small amounts, but when you have a lot of sugar in your blood, then you increase those reactions, and that can gunk up cells and cause a lot of inflammation. Just so we know the difference between glycosylation and glycation. All right, so those are the ways that sugar can really damage the body, and that is why we don't want to have such high levels of sugar in your bloodstream. The way that your body handles this, if you do have high blood sugar, is that your pancreas is going to secrete a hypoglycemic hormone called insulin. So we talked about the pancreas before. It's an organ that secretes enzymes for digestion, but also hormones. And we talked about how it secretes glucagon, which helps raise your blood sugar levels. But the islets of Langerhans in the pancreas also have these beta cells now. And these beta cells secrete insulin, which will have the opposite effect. The insulin is there to lower your blood sugar levels. So the way that the insulin is released is kind of similar to how glucagon is released in the alpha cells. So when you have high levels of sugar in your bloodstream, then a lot of that sugar can enter into those beta cells via, let's say, GLUT2 transporters, right? And they go into the cell, they go through glycolysis and the TCA cycle, and we make a lot of ATP. There's a high energy situation because we have a lot of sugar coming in, right? Now, again, in these beta cells, we have those potassium channels, remember? And normally, we do have more potassium in cells than outside of the cell, and the inside of the cell tends to be more negatively charged than the outside of the cell. We have these potassium channels, and when we have a high ATP situation in the cell, those channels are open. Okay, they sense that there's a lot of ATP and those channels are open. And as a result, some of the potassium can leave the cell. And potassium is a positively charged ion. So when it leaves the cell, the inside of the cell becomes even more negatively charged, right? So it becomes hyperpolarized. And this affects the voltage on the cell membrane. And again, in the cell membrane, we have these voltage-gated calcium channels. And those channels, when they sense this hyperpolarized situation, they are going to be firmly shut. They are not going to let any calcium in. In the case where we have low levels of ATP, because there's not a lot of glucose in the bloodstream, and so we don't make a lot of ATP within the beta cell, then the potassium channels on the membrane will close. And once those channels close, we tend to keep the potassium inside the cell. And because potassium is positively charged, then the cell becomes relatively less negative because of those positive charges, right? And we depolarize the cell membrane. Right, so the voltage is going to change, and now those voltage-gated channels, the calcium channels, are going to open. And once they open, they allow calcium to flood into the cell. And the entry of that calcium will release the insulin, prepackaged insulin, just like the glucagon. It's prepackaged in these little compartments within the cell. And once calcium comes in, then we release those packages to the cell membrane, and insulin can be released into the bloodstream that way. Okay, so once we have the insulin in the bloodstream, then what it does for blood sugar levels would be specifically in those cells that contain the GLUT4 transporter. If you remember, those would be specifically the muscle and the fat cells especially, right? Those have GLUT4 transporters, and so they are insulin sensitive. And as a result of insulin being released, then insulin can bind to the insulin receptor on the muscle cells or the fat cells. Once that happens, we trigger a series of reactions, you know, signaling reactions within the cell that will cause eventually the release of the GLUT4 transporter, which is inside the cell in a little compartment inside the cell. It's now released to the cell membrane, right, where it can now bring in glucose into the cell. In the muscle and also in the liver, the other thing that insulin will do is it will increase the formation of glycogen, right? So in muscle and in liver, insulin will actually signal the cell to form glycogen, because we want to take that excess glucose out in the bloodstream, bring it into the cell, and now we're going to package and store it as glycogen within the cell, right? And we will actually inhibit the breaking down of glycogen. We don't want to be releasing more glucose, so why break down any glycogen, right? So we'll inhibit that process, we'll actually promote the formation of glycogen. In the fat cell, right, and in the liver, then insulin will also increase lipogenesis, and this is actually making fat. So if you remember, the glucose can be converted to glycerol, and then that glycerol can be attached to fatty acids, and we can form triacylglycerol, which is the storage form of fat in your body, right? So we can store the triacylglycerols in an oil droplet in the fat cells. And in the liver, you know, the liver can also make lipoproteins, which then transport those fat droplets to different parts of the body. Okay, so in the muscle and in the liver, we promote glycogen formation, and in fat and in liver, we promote fat formation or triacylglycerol formation. We also in the liver then actually inhibit the process of gluconeogenesis. Don't want to be making more glucose because we've got plenty right now, right? So why make any more of your own? And in this way, your insulin helps you regulate your blood sugar levels. One thing I think it's really important to emphasize is that this really isn't an all or nothing situation. So if you're not a type 1 diabetic, you're always making some insulin, okay? It just is going to be much less in a fasted state, or if you have not had carbohydrates in your meal, okay? Or if you have very little carbohydrates in your meal, then you're going to have a lot less insulin, what we call a basal insulin level, okay? But it's not an all or nothing. So sometimes people think, oh, well, if you didn't eat carbs or you've been fasting, then you don't make any insulin. And that's not true. You just make a whole lot less. And then the more carbs that you eat, then, you know, your body needs to handle the excess sugars. And for that reason, you will actually make more insulin. Remember that those beta cells can sense, you know, the amounts of ATP that the cell is making, right? So the more sugar is coming in, the more ATPs are being formed, then the more the insulin can be released, which is the beauty of the system. Okay, because now we can really kind of fine-tune it depending on the needs of your body. Okay, so we talked about why it's important to regulate those the blood sugar levels, how high blood sugar can really be damaging to your body, and how your body regulates it in with the formation of insulin. Before I end, I talked a lot about how we have these inflammatory cytokines and inflammatory signaling going on in your body, and sugar can incite a lot of inflammation in your body. I thought it would be helpful to have a visual of what that might be like, okay? So this is how I explain inflammation on a very basic level to my patients. Imagine you're outside and maybe you fall and you cut yourself. So you have a cut on your arm, okay? And obviously it's going to bleed because you broke the skin. You're going to bleed, and then over time, you might note that area, it's hurting and it's swelling a little bit. It's a little warm and red, and it doesn't feel so good. Okay. So, we can understand when we've had a cut that the skin is broken. And so your body is going to try and defend itself against any possible infection. Right, so if there's some bug or germ on the ground, you don't want to have it go into your body. And so your body will send immune cells to that area, right? There's a rush of immune cells, and those immune cells, those white blood cells, will help to fight off any organisms that might be trying to invade and go into your body. All right, so you can think of inflammation that way within your blood vessels as well, all right? So if you think about your blood vessel, nice little blood vessel floating around, right? You can think of the sugar, right, that is in the bloodstream as little razor blades. Yeah, razor blades. Okay, and these razor blades are causing damage to the lining of your blood vessels. Okay, and when you cause damage to those blood vessels, you set off an inflammatory reaction. Remember the cut again on your arm, right? So over time, you bleed at first, right? But then the bleeding stops, right? We hope it stops. If you have some weird disease or a rare disease like hemophilia, then maybe you keep bleeding. But generally, it should stop. That's your body's way to protect you, right? Because it doesn't want you to bleed out. So the blood, you will clot, and then eventually you form a scab, okay? So if you have these razor blades damaging the insides of your blood vessels, then your blood becomes more coagulable, okay, which means it's more likely to clot, okay. And then we also have immune cells rush to those damaged areas, okay, because again, we want to defend against any damage in those areas, right? So those immune cells will rush there, and they will start to accumulate, and then they will send signals to get more immune cells to that area to protect that area, right? So what happens on your skin when you fall down and cut yourself on your arm? Well, you could think of a similar thing happening within the blood vessels, right? And if you think of these individual sugar units as razor blades causing damage to the interior of your blood vessels, then hopefully you'll get a sense of what inflammation is like, at least a visual, right? That's something I like to use with my patients, because all of a sudden something that's very abstract becomes very concrete, Okay, now I calculated this out and was really hoping that this episode would fall on Halloween. I think we're gonna be a few weeks out from that. Too bad. But my patients are very well aware that the sugar can be very damaging, and we have this image of razor blades, right, emblazoned in their mind, so much so that one of my patients said, oh, you know, Dr. Lo, at Halloween, we're always checking the kids' buckets for razor blades, but the candy and the sweets are the razor blades. And I'm like, yeah, and that's a pretty nice gory image for Halloween, right? That's what you're feeding your kids. Yeah. So every Halloween, we used to have a class called Metabolic Horror Stories, and it was very popular. I mean, we only had one person faint once because, you know, we were pretty visual too. We had slides, and it was a little bit gory in, you know, the general spirit of Halloween. And we did have one patient faint, but impressively, she came back to watch the rest of the class. Okay, so I was pretty impressed that she did that. But, you know, if you're having trouble envisioning what inflammation is like, just keep in mind those razor blades. Okay, very, very helpful image. Okay, on that very happy note, I think it's time for our wrap up. So today we just went into hyperglycemia, high blood sugar. You're supposed to have about 1 teaspoon of sugar in your entire bloodstream. And if you have more than that over a long term, then those razor blades can cause a lot of damage. Primarily, we form these advanced glycation end products, or AGEs, and these AGEs will gunk up proteins and also lipids and DNA. Anything it attaches to, it's going to cause damage to. Sets up inflammatory pathways in your body. It also stimulates this enzyme called NADPH oxidase, or NOX, to increase the formation of reactive oxygen species. Now, the ROS, again, can be very damaging because those molecules are highly reactive and they can cause a lot of damage and even cell death to the cells in the tissue. Because of this, your body tries to protect itself by releasing the hormone insulin, right? And in the pancreas, the beta cells can sense the amount of ATP that is available depending on the amount of sugar that's available in the bloodstream, and release insulin accordingly. When insulin is released, then in muscle and fat cells, right, it binds to the insulin receptor and causes a signaling pathway, which ends up in the release of GLUT4 transporter from inside the cell to the cell membrane to bring in glucose into those cells. In addition, in muscle and in liver, the insulin is going to increase the formation of glycogen, and in fat and in liver, it's going to increase the formation of fat so that we can sequester that excess glucose as glycogen or as fat in those cells. All right, I think we talked about it. Oh, and one other thing, obviously, that this is sort of a gradated reaction. We're not going to have no insulin when you're fasting. You always have a little bit of insulin, unless, of course, you're a type 1 diabetic. Okay, I think we have set ourselves up so that in the next episode, we can really go on to focus on insulin and also insulin resistance. Thank you so much for listening. Again, if you found these episodes helpful, please leave me comments, tell me what else you'd like to hear about. But for now, signing out from VLMD Rounds, I am Dr. Vivian Low, and I sing the body electric. Bye.